Good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Elizabeth Carney with the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for tonight's program, which is entitled When Words Don't Work. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events held here at the club. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dan Rohn. Dan Rohn is the author of the international bestseller, The Back of the Napkin, the most popular visual thinking business book of all time. Fast Company, Business Week, and The Times of London all named The Back of the Napkin the number one creativity and innovation book of the year. Dan is the founder and president of Digital Rome, Inc., a management consulting firm that uses visual thinking to solve complex problems for such clients as Google, Boeing, eBay, Microsoft, Walmart, Wells Fargo, the U.S. Navy, and the United States Senate. Rome and his whiteboard have appeared on CNN, MSNBC, ABC News, Fox News, NPR, and the White House. He lives in San Francisco. Now to talk about his new book, Dan Rohn.
Thank you all. Well, it really is a pleasure to be back here at the Commonwealth Club, and I say back here because I was here about, I think, 3 years ago. Just by a show of hands, is there anybody who came and saw my talk 3 years ago? Anybody who was here? Just a couple, that's good, because I have some of the same jokes. So, if they worked 3 years ago, I figure they're going to work really, really well now. They're probably really polished. So I have really a very simple story that I want to share with you this evening. And I'd like to think that this picture that you see over here is a pretty reasonable representation of, I think, a lot of what's happening in the world around us these days. I come from a business background, and I found myself in the last couple of years spending a fair amount of time also working with people in a lot of different areas in politics. And I am becoming increasingly concerned by the amount of words that are flying upon us, especially as we start to move into this next election season. Well, let's face it, this last year and a half has just been kind of crazy. And I'm getting to the point where I am becoming convinced that we are thinking that we are a lot smarter than we actually are because we can talk so well. And what I would like to do is try to imagine a world where the world didn't look so much like all of the blah, blah, blah that might be coming at us, but a world where we could start to imagine how might we be able to think really clearly and communicate incredibly clearly by perhaps not speaking louder and saying more, but perhaps actually by saying fewer words and speaking maybe a little bit more softly, and by spending a lot more time using our visual mind as opposed to just our verbal mind to solve problems. And that's what we're really going to talk about. So the way I think that's best to start this is I want to tell you two kind of case studies. And they represent to me kind of a spectrum of places where I have worked, where I've seen pictures and visual thinking be incredibly powerful. And that's kind of the good side of the spectrum. And then there will be the other side of the spectrum, the other story that I'd like to share with you, where pictures have not been very effective at all. And we'll talk about both. So in terms of where pictures have been really effective, one of my favorite projects of all time was a couple of years ago. I was asked to come up to Seattle, Washington by the Boeing company to come and do a workshop for a couple of days with some of the program managers up there. And when I got there, I realized that these were the program managers that are overseeing the development of the 787, so the new Dreamliner. This is Boeing's newest, latest, and greatest product, and arguably the most complex machine that has ever been made. But what was really interesting was what the engineers and the project managers shared with me, because what's fascinating is that the 787 is not being built in one place. For as complicated as it is, it's actually being built in 23 different countries by people speaking 17 different languages. So this chart shows us that everything that's in blue, light blue, is being built in the United States. So the wings, everything that's in red, is being built in Japan. The leading edges of the tail and the wings, everything that's in yellow, is being built in China. Everything that's in green is being built in Italy, and so on. So the question I had is, you know, how is this even conceivably possible that all of these people speaking completely different languages around the world can build their individual component, everything gets shipped back to Seattle, and within tolerances of, in many cases, millionths of an inch, everything just fits together? How is that even possible? Well, this is where the program managers at Boeing fascinated me, because what they showed me is the reason that they've been able to do that is because every aspect of the manufacturing, design, construction, maintenance, training, everything that has to do with this machine is built on a language of visuals. And it's not just some kind of sophisticated computer-aided design system that they're using. Of course, Boeing has been using computer-aided design forever. This goes much beyond that. The development of an entire visual language that doesn't matter what language you speak, because everybody's looking at the same images no matter where you are in the world, and when you need to know what you're supposed to do and how it's going to align perfectly with what someone else on the other side of the planet is doing, you look at the pictures. And what's really remarkable is that at the end of the day, the thing flies. It's pretty incredible. It works. So that's the side of the spectrum where I told you that pictures are really good and have worked very well, but I told you that there would be the other side of the spectrum as well. So now we're going to go in a different direction. We're going to go over to the other coast, where I have had an opportunity on a couple of occasions to work with the United States Senate and some other agencies in the government. And what's really remarkable is I have had a chance to work with the New Policy Committee of the United States Senate. Now, this photo is actually the Finance Committee, but the New Policy Committee looks very similar. And you know, the remarkable thing here is that whereas in case study number one, everybody wanted to make absolutely sure everyone they were working with knew exactly what they were doing, here you have a place where it does seem like everyone wants to make absolutely sure that nobody else knows exactly what it is that they're doing. And there are no pictures being used anywhere. And in fact, the outcome of this work always looks like that. The end product of all of that incredible amount of intelligent people who are doing really amazing work is this. And as we look at this, I can't say it flies. I don't know what's in there. What is the expectation, the amount of time that I'm going to try to spend trying to parse that? You know, I like to consider myself a pretty good citizen, but I'll tell you the truth, I've got no time to try to go through policy in that way. And I think that's true for so many of us. And the end result has been, of course, an incredible amount of discontent, if not outright hatred, that seems to be emerging because nobody knows what each other is talking about. I don't know what the other side is talking about. And all that happens is we talk more and we talk louder. So I don't think, when we look at political challenges, I don't think really that the issue so much is that people necessarily disagree with what our leaders are telling us. I think the problem is that we do not understand what our leaders are telling us. In particular, I don't think we understand what Washington is telling us at all. And I'll show you, as we have a little bit more time later on, an example where I'd like to think that I've been trying to help in this regard, and it's making an impact. So what I want to share with you is really the essence of my new book. Elizabeth had mentioned that my first book was called The Back of the Napkin, Solving Problems with Pictures, and I like to think that that title is pretty self-explanatory. My new book, though, is called Blah, 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 What to Do When Words Don't Work. And the essential tool in that book, I'm a big believer in things like mnemonics and any kind of memory hooks, anything that we can get into our mind to help us remember things. So I came up with this mnemonic, this kind of acronym that I call Vivid Thinking. And Vivid Thinking is my new favorite tool. Now, what Vivid stands for is V-I stands for visual, and V stands for verbal, and ID stands for interdependent. Visual, verbal, interdependent thinking, which means, we'll talk about this more in detail, that if we really, really want to take advantage of our brain's ability to think things through, we cannot rely anymore only on verbal language and most of what we've been taught in school. We can't rely on it anymore. What we need to start relying on and taking advantage of is this incredible amount of visual processing that we are all born with and which, sadly, none of us have ever been given any tools to learn how to improve or take advantage of. So that's what vivid thinking is. And in the end, what vivid thinking really means is we are not going to just talk, nor are we going to just draw. And let's face it, this represents about 95% of our population. This represents about 5% of our population. But neither side is completely right. What we need to do is combine both. But before this evening is out, and this was the purpose of the napkins that you have, I'm going to show you exactly how all of us can do this. So the one PowerPoint slide that I have in this PowerPoint presentation that I'm giving to you, the one wordy slide for those of you who really want to read something, is this one, and I can take you very quickly through it. I can paraphrase it. The essential idea of vivid thinking is this. Really, I will no longer believe that you really know what you're talking about. I will no longer believe that I really know what I'm talking about if I can only talk about it. Nor will I believe that you or I really know what we're talking about if we could only draw it. The fact is, to truly understand an idea, to truly make our idea vivid, we have to take advantage of both the verbal side that we've been trained so well to do and the visual side, which we are now going to start to be trained much better to do. So, in a way, you know, that's all very theoretical, that's all very nice, but let me try to make this practical for a moment. What vivid thinking is really about is taking an original idea, an idea that starts out in our mind or in a meeting, and, you know, this is a terrible photo of it, but what this is a photo of is a pile of coal. And, you know, we just came through the Christmas season, and, you know, what is the worst Christmas gift that you can give someone is a lump of coal. Now, the idea is, when an idea starts to percolate in our mind, it is like this big pile of coal. It's kind of messy. It's not very well differentiated. It's kind of dirty. Nobody really wants to look at it. It's not very appealing. But think of the potential that a pile of coal has. The potential is there. It's just unappealing when it's delivered in this way. And this, unfortunately, is the way that we tend to deliver most of our ideas. So what I want to do with vivid thinking, what we will do through this evening, is show you how to take this original idea, this undifferentiated, dusty, kind of ugly idea, and turn it into something that is absolutely crystalline. And think about this. The interesting part, and why I love this sort of visual analogy, this visual metaphor, is because, as we recognize, a pile of coal and a diamond are exactly the same thing. They are 100% carbon. All that's happened is that through a tremendous source of pressure and heat and process, this rough idea gets turned into something that is so brilliant and so beautiful and so clear that from something that nobody wanted to touch, it becomes something that nobody can forget. And that's what we want to do with our ideas. And we can do that. So now, if we could, let's just venture off here in a little tour for a moment. If we could do that, if we could combine our verbal mind and our visual mind, where would this vivid thinking really help us? Well, certainly it would help us in business. I mean, wouldn't it be great if we could look over the shoulder of the person sitting next to us in our office and actually see what it is that they're talking about? You know, it would be great in engineering. Rather than, you know, sitting down at the computer and turning on our computational fluid dynamics program, wouldn't it be great if we could actually see what it is that we're trying to build and interact with it, in addition to just talking about it? And in science, you know, wouldn't it be incredible if the machines that we use now could start to understand how we see things? And there's a tremendous amount of effort that's going on in this because, you know, the way I'm going to give you some statistics right now. I'm just going to veer off for a moment. When I start talking about the power of visual thinking, let's just assume that that circle represents all of the sensory processing neurons that we have in our brain. So that's to say, every neuron that we have in our brain that is processing incoming information about the world around us, everything we know about the world around us. Would you like to guess how many of those neurons are focused on vision? About 75%. In fact, it is theorized now that roughly 55%, 55 to 60% of every neuron in our brain, in one way or another, is focused on the processing of vision. You know, it's interesting because if you think about a hawk, you know, a bird flying up in the sky, got a fairly small brain, about 95% of its brain is focused on vision. 95% of a hawk's brain is focused on vision. And we humans, it's only slightly more than half. But that's much more than we have dedicated to verbal processing, orders, you know, much, much more than we have dedicated to memory or any other thing that we do. By virtue of being human, we are essentially walking, talking, visual processing machines. Now imagine what's going to happen when we start working with the machines that we are building who are able to see as well in science. That'll be fascinating. In the law, wouldn't it be incredible if the jury could actually see what took place and be able to see a model of what theoretically happened instead of just talking about it? In healthcare, wouldn't it be amazing if we could actually see what it is that the doctor is diagnosing about it, and what kind of procedures are being recommended if we could see them? Wouldn't it be amazing if in sales, instead of just having to sell at each other by talking, we could also draw pictures and have people respond to what they're seeing? Wouldn't it be incredible in politics if instead of just having people stand at the podium telling us, they could actually show us what their vision was about? Wouldn't that be incredible? And of course, wouldn't it be incredible if in education we had the ability not just to learn how to become incredibly good verbal learners, but also how to become incredibly good visual learners? And I do want to spend a moment on this aspect of education because I'm thinking, you know, where wouldn't vivid thinking be helpful for us? Well, nowhere. But the one place where we are not learning how to be visual is when we're young and we're in school, when we need to be. And I can kind of prove this, and I don't mean to harp on this, but if you think about it, I just want to look at the SAT test for a moment. Everybody's familiar with the SAT test? How many people in here took the SAT test at one time or another? The SAT test, for those of you who don't know, is the test that's taken by every high school student who's intending to go into college. And the SAT tests last 3 hours and 45 minutes. And for most teenagers, that 3 hours and 45 minutes is probably going to be the most important half a day that they're going to be spending in determining what is their outcome going to be in terms of future education. Because so much of your ability to be accepted at a university is based on your SAT score. If you look at what does the SAT actually test for, it has three sections. It has a section on math, it has a section on critical reading, and it has a section on writing. Those are the three things that you're going to be tested on in your SAT test. So let's think for a moment, what does the SAT test not test for? Does it actually in any specific way test for logic? Well, not really. Does it in any way test for multidimensional problem analysis? Not really. Does it test for creative problem solving? No. Does it test for some sort of mechanical, conceptual, physical reasoning? How do these things fit together? Not really. Does it test for visual spatial processing at 55% of our brain? No. Does it test for math? Yes. Does it test for reading? Does it test for writing? Yes. Now, those are critical things, reading and writing and math. Yes, we know. They're absolutely fundamental. But think about this. What this tells us is that our universities are accepting people based on this ability, but what about people's proven ability to be able to do some of these other things? And that's what I want to focus on a bit. So how vivid thinking works, vivid thinking, you know, it's both a term and it's a set of tools. It's a set of tools that I've created, I've worked with people to develop, that say the next time we hear a message that sounds very convoluted or maybe very complex, or the next time we hear a message which is just so long or so extensive that we can't quite follow it, there is a very simple set of visual tools, almost visual filters, we can put between ourselves and that message so we can begin to deduce what are the visual parts of that message that we can process so intuitively. So, the way this works, the reason all of this works, vivid thinking and visual thinking, is there are some unwritten sort of rules behind it. And the number one unwritten rule about why visual problem solving is so powerful goes something like this. It says, whoever best describes the problem is the person most likely to solve the problem. Now, what I mean by that is, you know, if Chicken Little came running into your office one day and said, you know, oh my gosh, the sky is falling, can you give me some money to fix it? You'd probably say no. But if someone came into your office and said, look, I've mapped it out, and isn't it interesting? Whenever this group of people gets together in this place and does this type of thing in this way, this problem seems to recur. If you would give me some more money, I would like to study that. The fact is, that's the person who's going to get the money. The mercenary subtext behind this rule is, whoever draws the best picture gets the funding. And I'm going to prove it to you. My favorite back-of-the-napkin story of all time. Now, after I had gone and addressed the Senate, the New Policy Committee of the United States Senate for the first time, after a very nice workshop where clearly we solved all the world's problems, a guy named Doug Steiger, who at the time was the head of New Policy Committee for the Democratic side of the Senate, came up to me and he said, "Dan, I have the perfect back-of-the-napkin story for you. And it involves an economist named Arthur Laffer. And we have to go back to the year 1974. So back in 1974, President Ford was in office, and Arthur Laffer, who was a USC economist, who was very conservative in his fiscal views, was kind of a darling of the Ford White House. So Laffer spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. One night in D.C., he went out to a bar, and we know exactly where this bar is, and we know exactly who he was with. He went out with two gentlemen who were senior aides to President Ford, and the three of them sat at the bar, and they started talking about taxation. And Laffer literally pulled out his cocktail napkin, similar to the one that you all have and we're going to use in a moment, and he said, "Guys, we're talking about taxation. I have an idea. Do you mind if I draw something out?" And they said, "No, go ahead." So on his napkin, he made a very simple little XY plot. And he said, "Okay, now, we're talking about taxation. So here on the horizontal axis, let's plot out the percent income tax rate that the government charges us from 0% income tax up to 100% income tax. And on the vertical scale, let's plot out the amount of tax revenue, the amount of money that the government collects from $0 up to lots and lots of dollars." And he said, "Okay, guys, now stay with me. If the government charges us 0% income tax, how much money is the government going to bring in?" "Zero." "Makes sense." And then he said, "But think about this. If the government charges us 100% income tax, how much money is the government going to make?" "Also zero, because no one will work. If we have to pay," and this makes sense, "if we have to pay every single penny of every dollar that we earn back as income tax, what would be the point of working at all? I mean, just go to the beach, you know, just forget about it." So what he said is there's actually a curve that goes something like this. "And isn't it interesting, gentlemen," he said, "at some point, the more you reduce the rate of taxation, the more you actually increase the amount of money the government collects." He drew that on that napkin, and he was with these two guys, and those two guys really liked that napkin sketch, and they said, "Can we have that napkin? We'd like to show it to President Ford." So he said, "Absolutely." They took the napkin, they showed it to President Ford. President Ford got it. He understood it. He liked the concept. He passed the napkin on to the Republican National Committee, who then passed the napkin on to the economics team of a guy named Ronald Reagan. That napkin sketch drawn in that bar in 1974 by Arthur Laffer is the first recorded instance ever of the notion of supply-side economics, the notion of Reaganomics, the idea that you could increase tax revenue by decreasing the rate of taxation, especially for the people who have the greatest amount of money. Now, interesting notion, interesting idea. You want to know who the two guys were who were in the bar that night with him? They were those two guys. Dick Cheney and Dom Rumsfeld were both senior aides to President Ford in 1974. It was those three guys sitting there in that bar that night that invented supply-side economics, invented Reaganomics. When someone would come to Reagan later on, it turns out that Reagan was a very talented drawer. Ronald Reagan drew all the time, and he was very good at it. When someone would come to him again and say, "Wait a minute, President Reagan, I don't understand this. We're lowering the rate of taxation. What?" He would draw them that picture, and they would get it. So the subtext I have for you, remember, the person who draws the best picture gets the funding. Who says a simple drawing sketched on the back of a napkin or on the back of an envelope or on a piece of paper or on a placemat does not have power? It has absolute power for a very simple reason. Because we are of two minds. And I'm not talking about left brain and right brain. I mean, everybody's familiar with the idea that, yes, we have a bilobed neocortex. Everybody knows, and everybody's familiar with the idea of right brain and left brain. Most of what we think about right brain and left brain turns out, sadly, to be wrong. It's a really nice model to say that half of our brain is synthetic and half of our brain is analytic. And it's a really nice model, gosh, it would be great if it were true, to say that half our brain is verbal and half is visual. It is not true. It takes our entire brain working together to do something as sophisticated as actually reading. What is true is that we are of two minds, and one of our hemispheres has evolved to optimize, to look at the world in terms of small pieces, to see the world in terms of the little bits. And the other half of our mind has evolved to see the world in terms of the wholes. In order to read, we need to be able to do both. It is true that most words are stored in one of our hemispheres. And if we only had that hemisphere, we would have a terrible time reading, because the other, the spatial, the more holistic side, is the part that fits the words together. It's the part that reads paragraphs and is able to make the spaces between words. So what's interesting is where this has brought us today is to a point where we really have split in half the ways that we think about the world. We have half our mind that sees the world like that, and half our mind that sees the world like that. So which half is right and which half is wrong? They're both right. The world is both of those things. But the trouble is, this is the only one that in really specific ways we have learned the abilities to train and teach and test for. This is the part that we say someone is intelligent. Are you verbal? Can you speak well? You're smart. Well, what about this part? This part that occupies so much of our capacity that we neglect. I want to try something for a moment. A little bit of it. It's not a test. It's more just kind of an interesting exercise. And I'd like you to follow along for a moment. I'm going to show you four pictures, and they will be A, B, C, and D. I'm just going to preview what you're about to see. I don't want anyone to get stressed out about this. This isn't some sort of, you know, can you see the missing puppy or something. But what I want you to do is just look at these pictures. There will be four of them. And just see if you can see that there are some things in the picture. And I'm intentionally staying vague. This is picture A. Do we all agree that there are some things in this picture? Okay, I'm now going to go on to picture B. This is picture B, and I'm going to go back and forth a bunch of times because I don't want anybody to get stressed and say, oh, I missed it. So I'm going to go back to A now for a moment. This is A, and let's go back to B, and let's go back and forth between these two a couple of times, back to A and to B. And does everybody see that between A and B, some things have changed? All right, we're going to do this one more time. I'm going back to A one more time. As I go from A to B now, I want you to ask yourselves one question. How much time do you think is passed between picture A and picture B? How much time, more or less? Seconds? Some number of seconds? Would we all agree that some number of seconds has passed? Okay, I'm going to go on to the next picture now. I'm going on to picture C. Does everybody see that something else has happened? Okay, and now I'm going to go on to the last picture. I'm going on to picture D. And we see that something else has happened. So now I'm going to go back to C for a moment and ask the same question. How much time has passed between C and D?
Hours.
Okay, rhetorical question, meaning we don't need to answer this. How do we know any of that? Because guess what? We didn't say a word. We didn't say, there was no written narrative. I didn't tell you anything about what was in those pictures. I mean, we've been through this a million times. It's just we never think about it. Our visual processing engine, we all just saw the same thing. And I'll bet most of us, if we were interviewed after this, would have pretty much the same idea of what we just saw. We were at least able to agree on how much time had passed without any real reservations. That is what I want to spend the rest of our time working on. How in 30 minutes can we become vivid thinkers? How can we learn to combine, when we're coming up with ideas, thinking about ideas and sharing our ideas? Let's get this rabbit, this bunny, aligned with this rabbit again so that we can start to really become vivid. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to show you on the back of your napkin. You'll draw along with me. Yes, and it'll be fine. How we can turn this lump of coal, this pile of coal, into this diamond of clarity. So, if there's anybody, does anybody not have something to write with? Is anybody missing a pen? I have some pens up here in the front. I was able to stop at Walgreens on the way over. So, would you mind distributing pens? Thank you so much. Okay, so as we do that, this is going to be a little bit tricky. I don't know. As I say, when I stopped at Walgreens, they didn't have the really good napkins that I like. They had these not such great ones, so I don't know how easy this is going to be for you. If you're struggling with drawing, if you find that you're drawing on the leg of your pants leg or something, I hate to say it, but this is the one time I'm going to let you not draw with me if you just can't make it work. But I hope everybody can. So here's what we're going to do on our napkin. We're going to draw a picture that shows us how to be vivid, how to vividly describe any idea that we want to come up with. So here's the way we start. When we start drawing a picture to explain an idea, the first thing we do is we don't panic. We don't think, oh my gosh, I can't draw. We don't think, oh my gosh, I don't know what to draw. We just draw a circle. I would like everybody in the upper left-hand corner of their napkin to draw a little circle. That's all we do. The drawing has now started. And now I'd like you to give it a name. And I'd like you to call it me. Hey, we're using pictures and words. Wow. And for a little extra credit, let's add the visual part. Make it look a little bit like you. And when you've done that, I would like you to then draw another circle about the same size on the lower left-hand side of your napkin and call that one my audience. To whom am I going to be showing my idea? And go ahead and make that look like someone to whom you would love to show your idea. And I often draw my mom here because I've been always trying to explain to my mom what exactly it is that I do. All right, so now we've got starting. This is how we draw every picture. We just draw a circle and give it a name and just call it us. That's the way we start every picture. We're always at the center of every problem we can think of anyway, so we might as well just put ourselves there. So now what we have is we have us and we have the person that we're going to share our idea with. Now, how are we going to make this person care about our idea? Well, we're going to make it vivid. So make a big circle in the middle of your napkin. This is my idea. And just like that pile of coal, it is undifferentiated, it's boring, there's nothing there. We're going to give it some structure. We're going to give this idea vivid structure. And the way we're going to start is we don't try to explain our entire idea all at once. Think of that idea for a moment as a pizza, a big round pizza. I mean, do we eat a pizza all at once? Well, there may be some of us who do, but most of us slice it up. So I would like you to slice your idea into six slices. And this is how we're going to make our idea vivid. We're going to work our way around these slices one by one, and we're going to do it fast. So here's what we do next. Label each slice. F, O, R, E, S, T. What does that spell?
Forest.
It spells forest. It absolutely spells forest. Why? Well, I'll tell you why. I told you earlier I really like mnemonics and things that can help me remember strings of ideas, and this is going to be a string of six ideas that flow. But more than that, when I stumbled across this mnemonic, I thought it's also perfect in the sense that when we need to make our idea really clear and really great, we do need to find a mental space where we can go where things are a little bit quieter than they normally are in business or in politics, or whatever it is that we do. We need to find a kind of a conceptual forest where we can go and be with our idea for a little bit and think it through. So that's what I'd like you to take away, if nothing else, from tonight. When you want to make your idea vivid, find this forest, and let me walk you through the letters now. So F stands for form. A vivid idea has form. And why don't you go ahead and draw a little square? And if you're really good and want to push it, go ahead and make it a cube. An idea that people remember and can see is an idea that has what appears to be physical form. Now, what I mean by that is a form could be something that looks like a map, a visual description of something like a bicycle. Now, for an engineer, for someone who's working on a machine, it's easy to represent the form because we just draw a schematic diagram of our idea. And everybody can see, well, that's a bicycle. It's a little bit trickier for those of us that might be in the social sciences. How do we find the form of feeling? How do we find the form of emotion? Well, luckily, a couple of nurses, Nurse Wong and Nurse Baker, invented something called the Wong-Baker Faces Pain Rating Scale, which was originally intended for use in burn wards, in pediatric burn wards, where children who are in tremendous amount of pain but lack the verbal ability to describe well what pain they're in can look at this picture, and the doctor can point to a part of the child's body and indicate this picture, and the child is supposed to indicate how much pain they're feeling based on this representation of feeling. Now, the remarkable thing is that the Wong-Baker Faces Pain Rating Scale has now been adopted by doctors around the world for use in emergency rooms or clinics where there is a language problem. where there's a language gap. And what's remarkable is that the Wong Baker Faces Pain Rating Scale, I love saying that, it's like a song, the Wong Baker Faces Pain Rating Scale, has now been tested in something like 112 different countries to always the same result. It doesn't matter where in the world you go. When you show people this picture, everybody understands exactly the feeling in exactly the same way, regardless of what language they speak. If you want to know what it looks like to be human and to feel, that's what it looks like. This is our lowest common denominator among people from a visual perspective. All right, so now there's another one. That's the form for social. But a lot of us are in business. So how do we show the form of business? Let's say that we wanted to sell someone on our new business plan. Is this a good way to show someone the form of our business? Does anybody really care? Is anybody actually going to read this? No, they're not. This is not a vivid description of a business. What is this? Does anybody know what this is? It's a TV dinner. And for those of us with more sophisticated tastes, it looks something like that. Does it? Yeah. You know, we're not going to give up. We're going to go to the bento box. Well, there is someone who has come up with a way of describing the form of a business idea in exactly the same way. Here's our bento box of a business model. What I mean by that is there is a gentleman who happens to be here tonight. Alex Osterwalder, right over there. Alex, would you raise your hand? Alex is a colleague of mine. We met through being in these circles of business writing. Alex published a book a couple of years ago called Business Model Generation, and it is the best business book that I have read because it is entirely visual. What Alex and his team have done is create a TV dinner, a bento box of the nine cells, the nine pieces that make up every business model. The form of what is a business model. And if you can use post-it notes or drawing to fill in each one of these nine little bento box areas, you start to build a model of the form of your business. And now you have a business that has enough form that someone will pay attention to it. The form is F. O stands for only essentials. And I'd like you to draw a little drop of water, or for those of you with a conspiratorial bent, a little drop of oil. When we explain to someone our idea and we want to make it vivid, we want it to stick to them. We want them to see it in absolute clarity so they don't get bored, they don't run away. It doesn't remain that pile of coal, but it becomes like a diamond. We only explain the essentials of the idea up front. Now, I've done some work with the U.S. Navy, and it's been fascinating. I do not come from a particularly military family, but it's been interesting to spend time with the folks at the Navy. And they taught me something, this very interesting acronym that they use. So if you're going to communicate in the armed forces, is there anybody here who's from the armed forces? Anybody who's been with the military or the Navy, the Marines, Air Force? Anybody ever heard of this notion, BLUFF? This is the acronym that they now teach. When you want to communicate, when you want to get your message out, you BLUFF. And what it stands for is bottom line up front. Bottom line up front. The first thing you say is, what is the takeaway? You don't leave the takeaway to the end. The first thing you say is the takeaway. And if you have made it compelling enough, or if someone cares enough, they will then give you all the time in the world to explain in all the detail you want what your idea is really about. And if they don't care, you're not going to bore them. So this is... I'm sure you all know what this is. This is a schematic diagram of internet security. I'm sure that leaped right off the page at all of you. This is from one of our large technology companies down in the valley. This is how they explain internet security. I was reading The Economist magazine 2 days ago, and I came across a new ad from another company down in the valley called Google. This is how Google is now describing internet security. We have a two-step verification process. First, you have to get past the bear, and then you have to escape from the snake pit. This is in The Economist magazine. This is Google's new model of internet security. Which one do I find more vivid? That one. And because I believe that there is a grizzly bear and then a snake pit, I will be willing to give that company all the time they need to explain to me technically how does that work. I'm not going to give any time to these people. This idea is vivid. R, recognizable. And let's put in kind of a parenthesis there, visually recognizable. A vivid idea, and I would like to draw this, draw a little sun floating over the water. A vivid idea an idea that we want to be that diamond to stick in someone's mind, unforgettable, and plant itself there where it cannot be forgotten, is an idea that is visually recognizable. What do I mean by that? Is it is an idea I have already seen before. I've seen it somewhere in my experience, and I recognize it. This, they tell me, is a model of business strategy. Uh-huh. Okay. I guess there's business strategy in there somewhere. What is this? Does anyone know what this is a picture of? It's the ocean. Does anyone know what this is? This is the best-selling business book of the last 5 years. Over 4 million copies sold. This is a book called Blue Ocean Strategy. Blue Ocean Strategy was not originally called Blue Ocean Strategy. It was called something like, and I forget the original title, forgive me, but I'll make it up, but it's close enough. You know, it is close to maximizing shareholder leveraging synergies in unmarketed and untested market competitive strategic space. And that was the title for the original HBR article, Harvard Business Review article, written by the two INSEAD professors. That was an incredible article if you happen to read the HBR. But then they decided to publish a book, and they realized that if they called it business strategy or strategic competitive anything, that no one was ever going to remember it. There's nothing visually recognizable about strategy or competition. What do those things mean? I don't know. Blue ocean makes a lot of sense to me. There's actually nothing about a blue ocean anywhere in the book. There is a new concept that says unexplored market competitive space is like a deep blue ocean. And that's pretty much the entire parallel. But the reason that this works is because the idea of competitive strategy put in something we recognize makes it vivid. So I went and tested this. Being a business author, I make it my, you know, important to me to know what other authors are doing. This is a set of visuals that represent most of the best-selling business books of the last 5 years. And let's see if we can go through and identify what recognizable visual cues are we picking up. Does anyone want to know what this book might be? Switch. Does anyone know what this book might be? Drive. Nobody ever gets this one. I guess it wasn't as big a bestseller as people thought. Snowball. This is the Warren Buffett story. Anyone know what this one is? The Long Tail. Anyone want to guess what that one is? Seth Godin? Oh, yes. Sometimes it helps if we put a little loop through here. Linchpin. Anyone know what that one might be? Duct Tape Marketing or Made to Stick. We already talked about that one. Anyone know what this is? Purple Cow, anyone know what that is? Whoops, see. Anyone know what that is? Yes, Black Swan. Anyone want to guess what that might be? Tipping Point. Anyone know what that one is? Anyone know what that one is? Absolutely. So what is it that Malcolm Gladwell and the Heath brothers and Seth Godin know that a whole bunch of non-best-selling business authors don't know? If you want to make your idea vivid, if you want people to get it from nothing more than the title, you make the title a visual. You make the title visually recognizable. We look at it, we know exactly what it is before we had to think about it. This isn't about dumbing down. This isn't about pandering. This is about saying ideas that people gravitate towards are ideas that we recognize visually. We're halfway around and we're going to make it. I promise we're going to get through the next 3 in the next 15 minutes, and then I promise we will have time for some Q&A. So, the next one is evolving. A vivid idea is one that does not stay static. And we can represent that by a square that becomes sort of a diamond. A vivid idea is one that starts from a really good place but continues to evolve. The way I like to think about this is a vivid idea, one that really sticks, one that we engage with, is an idea that is always complete, but it is never done. It's complete. There's nothing missing, but it's never finished. There is room for us to add something to it. The first parachute was designed by Leonardo da Vinci back in 1438. Nobody was crazy enough to actually try it for another 300 years when the Frenchman Lenormand actually built the parachute very close to the specs that Leonardo had written in his notebook, jumped off a tower outside of Paris and survived. And then Baldwin, in 1887, made a parachute that looks very similar to what we have today, and now we have the parasol parachutes. The point I want to make is the vivid idea of a parachute has never changed. this mechanism, this canopy under which we could jump from a tall height has never changed. That's something that even back in Leonardo's time was deemed important to have. What if you were in a burning castle? What if you were in a castle under siege? How are you going to get out of it and you don't have a long enough rope? How are you now going to get out of an airplane if you need to? The idea is there, and all that's happened is it was a great idea and we've continued to evolve it. Another person that in my own research I came to just think is phenomenal and kind of underrepresented these days is the original Steve Jobs, a guy named Edwin Land, the second most patented American after Alexander Graham Bell, 449 patents. Land was the inventor of the Polaroid camera along with 448 other interesting things, including optics, polarized sunglasses, you name it. And what Land was known for is he presaged Steve Jobs. For anybody who's ever read about Steve Jobs or anyone who ever read about Edwin Land, they worked in the same way. Number one, they were very obsessive. Number two, that they believed that they had an idea that was better than anybody else's idea because it was a good, vivid idea. And if they could keep evolving it and incrementally changing it and making it a little bit better and a little bit better, that it would continue to get better. And that was great. During Edwin Land's life, he really did revolutionize everything that has to do with optics and photography. Sadly, not long after he died, the company Polaroid did go bankrupt in 2001. 2001, I think Polaroid finally bagged it. But Polaroid didn't die because people came back and they said, there is such a great potential there. Let's keep evolving not only the product, but let's evolve the company. Does anyone know who's the chief creative officer for the new Polaroid? Lady Gaga. Talk about evolving a company. Lady Gaga was tapped and she is now the creative director of the new Polaroid. Talk about continuing to evolve an idea. Polaroid's making a comeback and it's doing some pretty interesting stuff. That's what I mean by evolving. How do we evolve an idea? Well, I've got a very tactical way we can do it. It's called the two-finger V approach. V not only stands for vivid thinking. You see, I've really thought this stuff through way too much. You know, V not only stands for vivid thinking. This is also the tool that we're going to use to make our idea evolve. And what I mean by that is we do let our fingers do the walking. This represents words and this represents pictures. And when we have an idea that we want to really start to fine-tune in the solitude of our forest, or with our team in the forest, we first write something about the idea, and then we draw a picture of what we just wrote. And then we write a caption that describes that picture, and then we draw a picture of that caption. And you only have to do this about two or three times, and you will find that a bunch of stuff that was really hard to get your head around when you were just writing the idea becomes very simple when we draw it. And the stuff that was really hard about drawing our idea becomes very simple when we write it. And you do that two or three times and your idea will just evolve all by itself and it will become very clear. S stands for spans, differences. Conceptual, but you'll get it when I show you the next picture. Spans, differences. A vivid idea is not one that says it is so. A vivid idea is one that says it is so and it is also that. It's not this or that, it's this and that. Let me show you what I mean. So everybody in the automotive industry for the last 100 years has known that if you were going to build a car, there was a binary equation you had to start out with. You had to say, am I going to build a car which is efficient or am I going to build a car which is powerful? Because it is inherent in the internal combustion engine that you can only get one or the other. It can either be efficient or it can be powerful. It cannot be both. And that is the reason why, you know, cars suck so much gas. But then somebody down in the valley again, you know, bless Silicon Valley and the thinking that goes on there, said, wait a minute. What would happen if we didn't start from the premise that every car has to be one or the other? What would happen if we could make a car that was efficient and powerful? What is the thing that is stopping us from doing that? Well, it's that darn internal combustion engine. So what would happen if we just put an electric engine in a car? And all of a sudden you get a Tesla, which is more efficient than a Mini and more powerful than a Hummer. And you didn't have to give up anything to do it. All you had to do was think not of an idea that is this or that. How would I make it work to be this and that? It's a fascinating way to think about problem solving. And our last one is a vivid idea. Is an idea which is targeted. Up to this point, you'll notice that we've been a little bit looking at ourselves. We've been a little bit solipsistic. We've been a little bit insular as we've been thinking about our idea. And maybe we're doing it alone in our quiet forest, or maybe we're doing it with our team in our quiet forest, but it's been focused on us. We went through and we said, what is the form of our idea? And how could we express only its essentials? And how could we make it recognizable? And how could we make it evolve? And how could it span differences so it's not just one or the other? And now we say, well, what about one of the most critical factors of all? Remember that person I had to share it with? An idea that does not have an audience is an idea of no value. I mean, it might be great to sit by ourselves and come up with a way to solve the energy crisis, but unless someone else buys into it, it's nothing. It's going nowhere. Nothing's going to happen. To make our idea vivid, we have to figure out how to target it. And in order to target our idea, it's very simple. We have to put ourselves in the shoes of this person and say, using our visual tools, what does the world look like to this person? What does my idea look like to that person? What does that person need to see in order to be inspired by all these other lovely things that I've done? This is a cup of coffee. This is a non-targeted idea. It might be tasty, and it might cost you 35 cents. In the old days, now it's going to cost you 75 cents just for that. But what would happen if we said, well, there's not just one type of person X, who likes coffee, but maybe we could identify a person A, and maybe we could identify a person B, and maybe we could identify a person Y. And what would happen if we said, well, all those people want something slightly different from the same cup of coffee? What would happen if we took that original idea and we found a way to target these different niches, different people looking at the world in a different way? Well, then we'd be able to go completely crazy and come up with all of this. And by the way, we're no longer charging 35 cents, you know. We're targeting. And I don't mean this from a patronizing sales perspective. I'm talking about we are in the business of coming up with ideas and selling ideas. If we can't do that, we can't do anything. And if we want to get people to listen to us, we have to get people to look at us. And that's what this whole thing is about. So there we have it. We made it all the way around our six-slice pizza. I can't believe it. We did it on time. Whew. And let me conclude with two final vivid pictures, kind of summarizing all of this. You know, clearly I've spent a lot of time sharing with you even this evening the power of taking advantage of our visual processing system. And there's research, neurobiology, evolutionary biology, you name it, we are visual. We've got to take advantage of that. And why are we visual? Because at some point in our past, it was of a benefit to us to be able to see the thing that was about to eat us before it got to us so we could run away from it. And so the question I ask is, why is vivid thinking still powerful today? Because it is the thing that's going to allow us to see the thing that's about to try to eat us before it does so we can run away and make it better. And with that, I'm done with my prepared remarks. I want to thank you so much for drawing that napkin with me. Thank you. Thank you.
At this point in the program, I want to remind our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on the radio that we're listening to Don Rome, who is with us today on the subject of When Words Don't Work. We are running a little forward in our program, so I invite you to come up and ask questions. We'll only have time for just a few. Is there someone who would like to come to the mic and ask your question? While we're waiting for that, I'll remind you that after the program, Dan will be signing books in the outer room. Please.
Hi, how would you recommend using this to bring a group of people together, a business team together?
Oh, absolutely. I am the person who's in every business meeting who can't stop drawing. So I'm going to answer your question with a bit of a story, if that's okay. So I'm the person who was in class, even as a kid, I was drawing all the time. And I went to UC Santa Cruz, just down the coast, and I did a double major in biology and in painting. which anybody who knows about UC Santa Cruz, that's the kind of thing that's expected of you. Which meant that when I graduated from Santa Cruz with a degree in biology and painting, I was sort of functionally non-employable, which was okay because I had a trade. I was a graphic designer. I knew how to do graphic design. So when I would be in graphic design, the fact that I drew all the time made sense. But then through this weird, circuitous series of events, I found myself in management consulting, where it did not make any sense at all that I was the one who drew. But I kept doing it. So I would be the person in the business meeting where typically, and this is where I'm going to answer your question, you get a bunch of people sitting around a table, and we've all been there 10,000 times. And what do? We talk at each other. And we have this illusion that we're listening really well to each other and we're understanding what each other is saying. But it is an illusion because most of what we're saying doesn't stick. This is the fundamental difference between a verbally delivered message, which by definition must be linear. It has to start here, just as we're talking now, and move along in time. And the only part that remains is the last few seconds. And we're lucky if we can remember where we started this conversation. The difference is if we had drawn it while we were talking about it, everything that we had discussed would remain visible and in front of us at the same time. So how to use this for a team? Assign someone to be the designated drawer. And when the meeting begins, just set a rule that says each major idea that's introduced or argument against that idea, someone will capture. And it doesn't have to be beautiful. It can be these stick figures or triangles or circles. I never draw anything that's more sophisticated than stuff like this. Because when you do that, you say, okay, you know, this is our business. And, you know, this is our competitor over here. And, you know, here's Washington over here. And you know, here's our shareholders here. Whatever. You see it. And when that happens, the dynamic in the room will change completely. Because all of the politics that were there, all of the stuff that was remaining unsaid, all of the fiefdoms and the ownership, it all drops away because everybody can suddenly see what we're actually talking about. You just got to start. Does that make sense?
It does. Thanks.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's only one last question.
How do you do this when you don't have a notepad and a paper and you're in a position where you have to speak about something and it's just you? And how can you draw these visuals into words?
Well, I never go anywhere without a pen and a pad of paper. So the first part of your question makes no sense to me. I can't imagine a situation anywhere on earth where you would not be able to have a drawing tool with you. And I don't mean that in a facetious way, but why wouldn't you? And, you know, here's an interesting side note. Had we had more time to talk, I would have loved to share with you a series of drawings that I created. About 2 years ago, I became very worried about what was going on in the healthcare debate in the country, the Affordable Care Act. Because I thought, you know, here the nation seems to be ripping itself apart over healthcare. It doesn't make any sense. What is it that one side is so upset about that the other side's not getting and vice versa? So I thought, well, I'm going to go right to the source. So I went to the congressional website, and I downloaded the actual pieces of policy. The first piece of healthcare policy that was passed under Nancy Pelosi 2.5 years ago. And I did look through it, and I realized that it's 1,500 pages of bullet points. It's an unreadable document. There's nobody on earth who can actually understand healthcare reform as it is described in policy. It doesn't make any sense. Healthcare reform or any other problem we face is a multidimensional, multifaceted problem. It cannot be described in words. It can't. It's impossible. It has to be drawn out because there are so many intersecting pieces. It cannot be described in words, which is why the policy starts to fail. Point I want to make is, in doing that research, I realized that President Obama used to draw a lot. In fact, when he was a community organizer back in Chicago, he would draw all the time. And if anybody's interested, if you just look up President Obama and drawings on Google or Bing or whatever your favorite search engine is, you will come across some pictures that he's drawn, which are pretty remarkable. We have a president who is exceptionally visual. Now, we all know that President Obama is also exceptionally verbal, probably the clearest orator in decades. Why is it that he gives the State of the Union address? Or why is it that he stands in front of the joint session of Congress to try to describe healthcare and he doesn't just draw a simple Venn diagram that says, look, senators and congresspeople, there are three things that I want out of healthcare. It has to cover everyone, it has to be affordable, and it has to be effective. If you cannot deliver me the intersection of those three circles, I don't want to hear from you. That's what I want. Then all of a sudden the issue is gone. I know that I've gone way off on a tangent, but we have to use our visual mind. Thanks.
Again, I want to thank Dan Rohn for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here at the club, as well as the radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.